and welcome to Anime's Journey to the West. I'm Cloyd. I've made some awesome pretzels, and here are my friends.
Hi, I'm Zeb, the dashing dishwasher.
Hi, I'm Lydia. My pronouns are they, them. And, yeah, that's it.
Hi, I'm Liz, the bodacious badass. I have she, her pronouns, and thank you so much.
So, really quickly, I don't think I asked this of you, Zeb and Elizabeth.
What's up?
How does a non-binary swordsman kill someone?
How?
Oh no, how?
They slash them.
Contempt. Have any of you watched any anime or read any manga in the last week that we haven't already talked about in that week?
I actually have. It was another Clamp anime, actually, and now I see what you guys are talking about with Clamp's quality kind of being hit or miss. It was Angelic Layer, which has a really cool concept and not so great animation. Also, yeah. A creepy man who puts octopi down people's pants.
I think that I read the manga of it, and I don't remember much of it, but probably the octopus guy was still there, but like it had the benefit of not having to have like an animation budget and just having to go off of the Clamp art, which was pretty good.
Fair.
Fun fact, the guy that made JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, he didn't believe Clamp was a group of women. He thought it was one guy.
Yeah.
Four women equal one man?
Apparently.
Until his, like, wife, who went to the same hairdresser as the Clamp group, met them, and she was like, yeah, hun, there are four women. He's like, oh, okay.
Fun fact, Yara the Clamp made a Doji Nessie of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. For cat coin, like, you know, what lays an egg that is he and Jotaro's love child.
Yep, and the kid's name is like Soapy Green, and apparently in the official JoJo Bizarre's Adventure Jolene's stand apparently smells like green dish soap.
Yeah.
So either he knew about it or that's just a very weird coincidence.
Knowing him, it's probably a reference.
Yeah.
Also, fun fact, that doujin they made of JoJo Bizarre Adventure, they basically filed the serial numbers off and made an original manga called Wish that basically has the same premise, except it's this guy and a genderless angel.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I've reached Act 2, but Axis is Homestuck, and unfortunately for y'all, I am slowly becoming Homestuck trash.
Uh-oh.
You are very late to that party.
I am! But yeah. Eventually, one of y'all is going to need to put me down.
Yeah.
Be like, this totally was, you know, like, we've got a lot of good memories with them, but we need to take them to the farm and go get a new Coley.
Yeah. Don't worry. When the time comes, I'll bring out the lipstick chainsaw.
Well, I was gonna say, you know, put me out of my misery with a bolt to the head, not a chainsaw to the gut.
What? No. I'll do the chainsaw to the head so it's quick. It's just.
That will be painful.
Only for like 2 seconds. It'll be very fast.
That's 2 more seconds than if you shot me in the head. Anyways, have you been trying to say something?
Yeah, so I've started watching, and you're probably going to hear this a lot now that we have this segment. I've started watching a new mech anime.
Another one?
Yeah, this one is called 86. It's a pretty interesting anime with a very good animation that takes place in this country where it seems like everybody has silver hair and I believe gold eyes. And when I first started, I was just like, wow, it's kind of weird that they do that. And like the thing that they say is that they have like these that everybody is able to live in peace despite the fact that they're in this war with a brutal empire, because they basically run all of their mechs off of an AI. And at first it seems like it's just like this story about this like one girl who's this commander of this unit, and you might be thinking, why would an AI need a commander? And that's because it's all a horrible lie, and where this actually takes place is a brutal ethno-state where all of the people who don't have silver hair and golden eyes have been declared not human so that they can use them in their horrible war. And it's about her kind of evolving. It's about the squad that she is allied with. And it has some fairly cool stuff of her. I'll say that there's like... It has one anime trope I'm not fond of, where like the dudes all watch the girls bathing, though it's like kind of like made like slightly less creepy because all of the girls apparently bathe fully dressed, so I'm not really sure why they even had this sequence. But yeah, other than that though, I've really liked it. It has kind of Iron-Blooded Orphans vibes, and I've been enjoying it a lot. I'm still only on the third episode. Well, I've finished the third episode, but that's as far as I've gotten so far.
Yep. Also, I saw a tweet that I first agreed with, and I realized, oh no, this would only make things worse. And that was, yeah, someone needs to pull a Watchmen on the, you know, anime harem genre and deconstruct it. Watchmen is really good, but here's the thing about deconstructions like Watchmen, Evangelion, and Madoka. The imitators will be so much worse.
The other thing is that the anime harem genre has been deconstructed several times. People just aren't aware of the deconstructions. Yep. Anyway, we should start by giving a trigger warning.
Could I just mention a manga I read recently?
Sure.
Yeah. I read a really great manga graphic memoir called My Alcoholic Escape from Reality by Nagata Kabi. She's written My Lesbian Experience of Loneliness and My Solo Exchange Diary. It's all about her dealing with her pancreatitis diagnosis and struggling with alcoholism, and whether, you know, the ethics and morality of making a memoir, including your loved ones in it, and just creator's block and all that. It was really great. She talks about mental health and physical health, and I think if you really like that sort of thing, if it's a subject material you're comfortable reading, I would definitely check it out.
What did you say that was called?
My Alcoholic Escape from Reality by Nagata Kabi.
I might have to check that out.
It's really good. You don't have to read her other graphic memoirs to know what this is about, but I would highly recommend reading them just to get the full picture.
All right.
And as Deb was saying, we should have a trigger warning to start with this episode.
So this episode has...
heavily implied child sexual abuse, and like if you do the math by paying attention, some weird, hopefully third cousin incest stuff.
It's a mess. We're gonna get into it, and we're gonna talk about Montague's tragic backstory now.
Yeah. So. Romeo x Juliet, Episode 17. Cruel Pirate. Darkness. The Origin. We open on a carriage going along the countryside. William and Amelia are in it, along with Conrad. Amelia is very excited to go to the House of Nobles because she still has her career goals in mind. She suggests William throw a party and invite everyone he knows. Conrad grumbles curmudgeonly. guess why they had to bring him? William gets mad and complains about how he has not the slightest bit of kindling sparking his soul. He says that the hills give him nothing for comedy and doesn't bring to mind heroes of the past. He continues to complain of his love of tragedy and drama. Even Amelia thinks he's being a little too extra. I would watch an entire episode just about these three on a road trip.
Same. I would watch an entire anime about these three.
I would too. I low-key want slice of life these three. Give me like 12 episodes.
Yeah, for sure. So, in the mountains, Paulo reveals that Montague's verdict was that none of the laborers could ever return to the city. Giovanni is enraged and grabs Paulo, but Romeo stops him. Romeo decides they should cultivate the land around the abandoned village he and Juliet stayed at for a while. So, Juliet and Conrad greet each other warmly. Amelia asks why she's dressed as a girl, and William explains that she is a girl. Amelia has a way over dramatic reaction. Conrad returns the Capulet sword.
I have a theory, and that theory is that Amelia is struggling with her sexuality because she always had a crush on Odin.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that that's just text, especially after next episode.
You know, that's fair, actually.
I think that Amelia's plan has always been to be a sugar baby with a side piece, and that side piece was going to be Odin.
I think Amelia just realized a new market has opened up. Sugar baby for rich noblemen, but also sugar baby for rich noble women.
Yeah.
So Conrad returns the Capulet sword. She says she's finally strong enough to carry the weight of her father's sword, and she says, "Thank you for granting me a second chance to be worthy of the name. I will run from it no longer." So, in the market, Balthazar, Regan, and Antonio are shopping. Antonio complains about how heavy the bags he's carrying are. Regan tells him not to complain and accuses him of trying to pawn his work off on a delicate girl. He mutters that there are no delicate girls present, and he pretends not to have said anything.
But before anything else can happen,
he sees Camille walking down the street. So when he reports to the others, Curio and Francisco are like, "So obviously Camille lured us into a trap." They go to find him, and Juliet joins them. They tail Camille from the bar that he's day drinking at to a nice home. They burst in. Camille shows that he's not very good at being a traitor because he immediately is shocked that they are alive and calls them rebels and makes it very clear he thought they were all dead.
Yeah, he's not so good at the intrigue stuff.
Yeah, the only reason he's ever been good at it is that one of the only people in the main group who's cynical and suspicious was an old friend of his, and the other cynical and suspicious people were willing to go along with him.
Also, he did, like, outright say that his morals were dusty, and nobody, yeah, like, picked up on that.
Yeah.
Or they thought the implication was like he's good with rebellion. Like he's like, "I'm down for this."
Yeah. So Tybalt is waiting for them in his new sleeveless shirt. Camille
and the Tybalt fans take this as a sign to do a more horny fan art. If you aren't doing horny, then why aren't you?
Why isn't there any fan art of this? I'm so mad that this anime didn't get bigger.
Yeah. So, Camille runs to him for help, but Tybalt threatens him with a knife for sneaking out on his own. Camille accuses him of putting a blade to the neck of the person who raised him, and everyone else is surprised. Tybalt responds, "Try anything like that, and my knife will be the last thing you see." Then he throws him out. Bye, Camille. This will be your last appearance on the entire show. Juliet asks Tybalt if Camille is his father, and he walks away into his angst room. So when Juliet follows him, he's looking up at a giant family portrait. Juliet recognizes it as her family. She asks if Tybalt is a son of Capulet. He reveals that the woman in the far corner is his mother, but that Prince Montague is his father. He reveals that Montague seduced his mother, then abandoned her when he grew tired of her. She died giving birth to him. Since no one knew that what Montague would do if he found out about him, he was raised by Leo until he left home at 15. I really kind of want to know what the relationship between Camille and Tybalt was like, other than the one scene that we saw.
Yeah, I do too.
Was he a good, like, adoptive father figure? Was he, like, kind of crappy at it? Was he just like, I'm doing the bare minimum?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, did it turn out that Camille was, like, short that he'd be like, hey, son, want to go drink a beer? AKA your average Severn dad.
Or was he more like, hey, here's some food, here's some water, don't bother me. I got stuff to do.
Yeah.
I got bitches to fuck.
I kind of imagine Camille was like unintentionally distant.
Yeah, probably. So, Tybalt says, it matters not what his original intentions were. My mother was used by his will. Your parents murdered by his hand. Our families slaughtered by his desire. And for this savage act of butchery, we gave him the crown. So we cut to Neo Verona, where Prince Capulet is unveiling a golden statue of the goddess. I'm just going to know all of the women in the background have really cool hats. Anyways, he is greeted by Lady Ariel. She asks if this golden idol will be enough to quell the people's worries. He jokes about the sharpness of her tongue and asks how William is doing. She says he's still wasting his time in the theater, but she tolerates it since the house is mostly steered by its women anyway. She says that both of them have trouble with her son, with their sons, and it's funny to think they'll have to give the city over to such witless youth. He says, the mind recoils. I'm pretty sure this is one of the only times we've seen him just enjoying a normal conversation where he's not doing something evil. So Titus comes over and says he'd heard that Lady Ariel wants the Capulets back. He notes that if she didn't wield the power that she does, Montague would probably love to have her strung up for treason. Two things. I don't actually think that this is an... From the conversation that they just had, I don't think this is actually an accurate summation of Capulet's relationship with her. And also,
you mean Montague?
Montague, yeah. And also, he's about to, like, literally ask Montague for a favor. I don't know why his way of starting that is to make fun of him for not being able to kill someone. That seems like a bad foot to start on.
It's called negging, Zeb.
You can't neg Prince Montague.
Sure, I can neg Prince Montague. Hey, Prince Montague, your beard would be better if you groomed it more.
Prince Montague, your face your face would be better if you didn't still look like Ivan the fucking Terrible.
Hey, I think, didn't we all agree Ivan the Terrible was baddie?
Young Ivan the Terrible, and we're going to be talking about young Montague in a little bit.
Who, young Montague does not look like young Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah, so,
But also, one other thing I did want to say, the reason I feel like he actually has this conversation that he enjoys with her is that she is one of the few people that he sees as an equal.
Yeah.
He's like, I didn't have to step over your corpse to get where I am, and I respect that about you.
Yeah. So, Titus asks Montague to adopt Mercutio so he can be the prince when Montague dies. And basically blackmails him with all the sins he's buried for him. Montague looks absolutely enraged as everyone else runs inside due to the rain. Montague stays out, and he starts to have villain origin flashbacks. Tybalt mentions a rumor that Montague was the son of a sex worker. As we see Montague arrive in the House of Lords, we get a flashback to him as a child. A sex worker tells him to polish some shoes outside. Mercutio arrives with his father. Mercutio promises to be at Montague's service. Titus celebrates. Mercutio offers to call for wine, but Lord Montague suggests they do a little sport with a blade. He mentions that Titus used to be a quite talented swordsman. Mercutio is surprised and impressed to learn about this. So we cut to Montague as a child. A shitty noble slaps his mother and then him. He looks angry. Back in the present, Montague attacks Titus viciously, saying, "You claim I asked you to dispose of my past. You dare insult my honor with your vitriol and lies?" When Titus defends himself, saying that Montague asked him to kill people to erase all vestiges of his past, Montague yells, "I have no past!"
I do have to say that I really, really like the juxtaposition of the like flashbacks with Montague's like tragic backstory with his current acts of cruelty and viciousness. And I think it makes for a really, really good bit of storytelling.
Yeah. I have a somewhat critical relationship with this episode, which we'll get to towards the end, I think. But one thing that I do like is that often I feel like villain origin stories are revealed, like especially in some anime, villain origin stories get revealed at like the last minute to make the villain like more sympathetic, even though they've been like pretty shitty throughout the story. I do like the fact that that when this one does it, it juxtaposes it in such a way to give like something of an explanation for the why he is the way he is, but it doesn't justify it. And the fact that he's doing like really specifically some very nasty things within this episode, and he's only going to get worse in the next few, gives like a slightly different relationship with that backstory, I think.
Mm. And I think I do like when an origin story, especially for a villain, it doesn't justify or, you know, go, ooh, woo. It's kind of like, okay, how do you get someone to do this? Like, what is the starting point? Because this is the end result. What is the starting point in between to get to this?
Yeah.
I like how it explains his actions, but does not excuse them.
Yeah. So we cut back to him as a child. His mother, sick and dying, tells him of his family and that in a better world, they would have lived as nobles. As she dies, Montague begs for her to live. But as the candle goes out, he sees the Capulet crest on it and throws it away. Still in tears, he says, "Capulet," his face transformed by rage and hate. In the present, he charges Titus, "I will see the House of Capulet destroyed." Tybalt's voice says, "From then on, he cast himself to nothing but revenge." We see young Montague's face being creepily stroked by an older noble. That was what the trigger warning was for.
Because there's some heavy implications with that.
Yeah. He worked to become a ward of House Montague. We see blood falling in a bowl. through poison and plot. He murdered his way to succession. Just going to say it here, this is probably one of the only murders that Montague does that's just, like, pretty much 100% justified.
Like, the one thing Montague did right.
Yeah. We see him as an adult, and I'm very sad to report that he was indeed hot. Though his sharp features really resemble Tybalt more than Romeo.
I think Romeo gets his softness from his biological mother.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, though, this is what I've been saying all along, like, Prince Montague is daddy.
No, he's not. Being hot when you're young is not and then ugly when you're when you're old is the exact opposite of daddy.
Honestly, I don't think Prince Montague is that bad looking when he's old.
I can't get over the fact that he looks like Ivan the Terrible.
Sure, old Prince Montague isn't a fuck machine, but if he wasn't such a horrible person, I'd do him.
Okay.
This is going into Zeb's broken channel, isn't it?
I can't. The thing that's actually breaking me is the fact that I can't give you too much shit about this, because last episode I said that I'd let young Stalin do things to me, and I just want to note that I am very ashamed of the fact that what I didn't say was I'd let him seize my means of production. Right.
Oh, we fuck. See... I got Stalin mixed up with Mussolini.
Mussolini, I don't think, was ever hot.
I don't know Mussolini why.
Mussolini also was always just a little fucking punk of a bitch.
I don't know why, but, like, even last episode, I was like, oh, okay, I guess he likes Italian dictators. Okay.
No. No, I like Russian dictators before they were Russian dictators.
You're like horny Russian dictator hipster. I liked them before they were Russian dictators.
So, we see him approach Tybalt's mother. We see him flirting with her, but smiling sinisterly to himself. We see him spying on the Capulets talking to Ophelia. Titus tries to run as Mercutio stands frozen in horror. Tybalt growls, "For every dreadful act, I will bring my bloody revenge on him 1,000 times back. He is beyond forgiveness. No matter how long it takes, Montague must die!" At that moment, Montague kills Titus. Juliet says that Montague and Tybalt are very similar people. Tybalt turns, and as if to reinforce this, Montague turns the same way. He asks Mercutio if he's still willing to pledge his faithfulness. Mercutio, trembling, swears himself. Montague tells him to kneel and says, "Know this. If you are to cultivate ambition, fear and hate are the secret kings of men. The rest is left to you." Mercutio looks up at his father's corpse.
I have to say, like, I know he does a villain speech pretty close to every episode, but every villain speech he gives is just wonderful.
Yeah.
God, he is an absolute bastard, but it is very entertaining to watch.
Yeah, he is a very good dramatic villain. So, Tybalt is enraged and demands Juliet admits she hates Montague. She says...
Hey, I just realized something.
Yeah?
If Prince Montague is a prince, doesn't that mean that Neo Verona is a principality?
Yeah, that is what it means.
Huh, okay, anyway, go ahead.
I think that like Venetian city-states are like kind of the reference point for Neo Verona.
Yeah, I assumed that as well.
Yeah. So Tybalt is enraged and demands Juliet admit she hates Montague. She says, "I love him because of my love for his son. I cannot muster my hate. Not after Romeo. Not anymore." And then after this, we cut to Ophelia, who says, "The land laments. Waters run dry. All things that grow must die." Montague tells her, "Never forget. I am the prince of Neo-Verona. One of the fruits of the tree falls rotten." So the preview is, "Our past defined by yet unfinished acts compels us resolutely to the fore. No wiles, no revolutionary pacts can destiny in want of love restore."
Oh yeah, I need to say one thing about the ads on Funimation again. So, thanks to Funimation streaming service being a bit messed up, I had to back out of it, go back in, and it led to a long sequence where I literally saw the same ad a goddamn 9 times in a motherfucking row.
Yeah, I mean, Crunchyroll isn't necessarily as bad, but it has similar problems.
Everybody has their own way of being creative. What about yours? The Adobe Bundle package is a great way to show off your creativity in the world. That is me quoting the same Crunchyroll ad. It's that cool little, it pops on, it's like, it's like, you know, you are like the guy singing it and doing the little ad. He seems like a very nice man. He seems wonderful. I'm like, good for you. Glad you're succeeding. But I need to not see your face every 5 minutes.
I mean, the one for me is the gacha game Breath of the Wild.
Genshin Impact?
Yeah, Genshin Impact. "People tell me if I just spoke more softly, others would find it easier to forgive me. I condemn you," and then like all her other lines. Anyways, so yeah, that's the episode.
I have one critique.
Yep.
I'm a little disappointed we don't get flashbacks of his relationship with Romeo's mother.
Yeah, actually, that is an interesting thing.
Because it seemed for a while he might have, okay, once he married her, he might have cooled his heels a little bit. Because from what previous conversations they had in previous episodes, I understood it as he committed the coup sometime during their marriage, like maybe a couple years after their marriage. And he seems like he generally loved her, or that he had some affection for her, or vulnerability for her that he was not comfortable with. While she's like, "You never loved me. You never gave me the love I wanted from you."
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering, wait, why was Romeo's mother ever even interested in him? Is this a thing like
an arranged marriage?
Arranged marriage?
I mean, from what we see, like, the thing that we have to remember is that we're seeing Prince Montague after, like, decades in power. He was a young man at this time. He was charming. He was handsome. The implication from his relationship with Tybalt's mother is that he was charming. And, like, we see him as, like, this, like, rage obsessed, vengeance obsessed dude, but back then he might have been able to channel it into like more of just kind of like this intensity that might be considered kind of hot. Like, we have seen a character who has that same intensity, and it could be considered kind of hot, and his name is Tybalt.
Yeah, for sure.
So wait, you know, here's something that occurred to me. What's going to happen if Tybalt and Romeo do end up growing up? Are they going to turn up? Are they going to look like a Papa Montague?
I mean, if they don't get consumed by hate, I think, you know, I've seen memes, people going like, "Yeah, white supremacy and hate just really fucking ages you. It really makes you a ghoul." And I'm like, you know what? You're right.
Like, I mean, a lot of Prince Montague's physical features are, like, not exactly helped by, like, the fact that he never smiles, and when he does, it's like an evil grin or smirk.
And, you know, I'm just going to say it, stress and anger, they age you. They really do. He's probably not as old as he looks, is the thing.
Montague has been furious for his entire life. Like, this is a thing. This episode, one of the things I do like about it is the revelation of his past. Makes part of what makes it make sense to me is the fact that it never did really seem like it was just a power thing for him. Like, sure, he's interested in power and stuff, but it's always been really apparent that he's, like, that there's, like, there's just this deep rage inside of him. And we see that whenever he talks about the Capulets, and now we know why.
God, it's so cool the way they framed it to, like, explain his backstory without giving him that unearned moral ambiguity.
Like, that prediction that Coley did in the first episode was half right.
That we were going to learn his tragic backstory?
Yeah, well, Coley said we're going to learn his tragic backstory and then unearned moral ambiguity, baby. And then we did learn his tragic backstory, but there wasn't really the unearned moral ambiguity.
And I like how his backstory explains some of his characteristics while not excusing them. Like, he's obsessed with power and crushing those beneath him because that's what happened to him in his childhood.
Yeah.
And what happened to his mother and people like them. I'm just going to say this now. If you're really angry, you got some trauma, please go talk to somebody. Go seek some help. Channel that into something healthier. A healthier hobby than revenge.
Like, the thing that I like about the way that his backstory is framed, the backstory makes it really clear that he becomes more or less a worse version of the thing that happened to him, because he did the same shit. Like, it wasn't a sex worker, it was a noble lady, but he still fathered a bastard child and then abandoned the mother. Like, he did the same shit. He ends up, in a lot of ways, becoming a lot of the things that he hated. Like, he also fathers a bastard child. He technically isn't told in the same way, because it's not necessarily a refusal to acknowledge Tybalt when Tybalt is growing up, because they did hide Tybalt from him. But he did abandon the mother, and I think it's implied. The implication I got was that he knew that she was pregnant, abandoned her, and then they told him that Tybalt died during the childbirth.
I could see that.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
And I like how it also kind of, like, you know, his existence kind of shows that the Capulets weren't a perfect family, and I also think Montague got away with his coup because he lets the nobility have so much power.
Yeah.
And he just basically lets them treat the commoners like trash even more than they probably did to begin with.
He encourages them to do so.
Yeah, he makes dramatic speeches about how commoners are nothing more than grapes, and that they are going to harvest all of their sweet nectar.
Like, oh
God, that's probably my favorite villain speech of all time now. Like, it's very over the top and very dramatic, but it's amazing.
Yeah, like, the thing that Montague shows is that you have to have class consciousness, because otherwise, even if you do manage to somehow get into, like, a position of wealth, you're just going to completely sell out everything, all of the people around you. And that's what he does. He calls them
grapes.
Yeah, he technically by blood, he'd in a lot of cultures still be considered kind of part of the nobility. He was from, like, this working class background. He was treated as a commoner. he found his way into being a noble, and like, and he basically, as soon as he did that, completely sold out and became the worst version of himself.
Can I just say this?
Yeah.
If Montague existed today, he would do an interview with a newspaper or a publication saying, like, I'm only 30 years old and I bought this palace. Here's how. My rich adopted father bequeathed me a lot of money when he passed away unexpectedly.
I got a small loan of $1 million.
My grandma bought my house for me, and then I rented that house out and got and used the rent for that house to buy the one that I actually wanted.
Like, Montague isn't in quite the same position because he was raised as a commoner and only really got to be the ward through a very disturbing means, and also a honestly fairly justified murder.
Same, same, but just for the sake of memeability. Just for the sake of the meme.
You have a point, Zeb.
Yeah.
You do have a point. Just for the sake of the meme, just because I'm thinking of that stupid article of that rich person going, oh, I financed this all on my own.
Yeah.
Also,
my parents bought me this house and gave me a loan of $50,000 so I don't have to pay it back, they said.
Yeah.
Also, going back to the thing Elizabeth said before, I have a lot of trauma and anger, but I channel it into, like, apparently writing lately.
Yeah.
And drawing and doing this and my cross stitch. And
it's great. It, honestly, it's really great. Writing is like a lot of like therapists and a lot of successful writers were giving the advice like, hey, you have trauma. Why not start writing? Like Tyler Perry got involved with writing because his therapist recommended he start doing it to heal from some childhood trauma that he had. And he's a very successful writer. Whether or not you like his work is another thing, but
I love Tyler Perry's work. Medea is amazing.
I'd like to see it as the original stage play that it was made, because you can kind of tell from his film work that he definitely thinks film as the same framing and staging as a stage play.
That's fair. I really liked, there were a couple TV shows of his that I really liked.
I remember seeing one. It was about, it was like, like one of the main characters adopted a girl from foster care that had trauma, and I liked how they worked with, I remember seeing a few episodes, I'm like, oh, that's really nice. I like how they address it. Like, they're like, oh, she should probably go and see a specialist for her therapist because some things are still not working, even though she has a loving environment, and she just needs to find some tools to cope that we cannot provide her, but we love her and will support her. I thought that, I'm like, that's really nice.
Yeah.
I think it might have been House of Pain was the one I really liked.
I've seen a few of his early films, and I think they're really nice, but I would really like to see the original stage play because you can kind of tell just from his camera angles and how he uses setting that he definitely thinks in the mind frame of a stage.
Yeah, that's fair. That's definitely very fair.
And I would love to see it as a stage play just to see how different it is and to see, because I think stage play and film, you definitely have a difference in how you view it. And I think, ironically, Juliet x Romeo shows that.
We're going to be talking about stage plays very shortly.
Oh, also, I did have one more thing that was relevant to the episode.
Yeah.
I abhor Juliet's sentiment of, no, I love him because he's the father of this guy. Like, nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
I think thematically for, like, because I think a big theme of this in general is, like, you know, love instead of hate, you know, violence and killing will not absolve violence or something. And I get thematically why it's there. But realistically, I'm like, this kind of sets a dangerous precedent for real life.
I think that it's fine. Like, that's a thing where I just think I disagree with the thieves of the show. I think that it's fine to hate your oppressors.
I want to see her be like, no, this is a dude who hurt my guy.
Like, this man tried to murder me. Like, oh, she can forgive him just if that makes her feel comfortable, but she doesn't have to love him.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, like,
Are they using love and forgive interchangeably in this context, in this exchange, or...
I'm not sure. It's like a weird thing, because on one hand, part of me just kind of recoils from it, because I do think that it's fine to, like, hate your oppressors and that sort of thing. And I think that if we're going to go into, like, cycles of hate and stuff the way that this show is, then it needs to, like, I don't know. I feel like the show very much does design basically all of its villains to be hated. But on the other hand, like, what she says about, like, how Tibalt is, like, basically like his father when he was younger is more or less just true, too.
Because, it is, like, it really is.
Yeah, so, yeah. So, like, I do have, like, a fairly complicated relationship with that phrase, but yeah, I do agree that it's, like, probably the part of it. It's definitely the part of the episode that I liked the least.
What I wanted to see was I wanted to see Juliet be like, he is a tyrant, but I don't hate him. He needs to be stopped, and there needs to be an end put to his tyranny and madness, but I don't hate him. He is what he is, and we're going to end him because of it.
Yeah. I do think that she's presented as being kind of still conflicted about what she's supposed to do in the next episode. So there's a possibility that this is just building to an arc. I truly do not know. I have memories of this show, and this part of the show is some of the beginning parts are the parts that I have the strongest memories of, but I don't remember everything.
All right. So, yeah. Are we about ready to go to the next episode?
I just want to add one thing. I've noticed this kind of, like, the similar backstory Monty, who has, of, like, adopted by a noble family from Commoner, but sexually abused. I noticed it's popped up in anime a couple times, and even Fire Emblem recently had a character that had a similar backstory.
It pops up even in, like, one of the it pops up in Gundam, too.
What, I don't Wild. Think I don't think I've seen it in Western works, to my knowledge. I might be wrong. But it's a very interesting... I'm not saying, like, nobility in the decades never did that. I just think it's very interesting, just that it pops up in anime a lot.
Yeah.
Anyway, next episode.
Okay.
Yeah, next episode. Let us get started on the episode. So this episode is called Aspirations in Each of Their Hearts. A wagon drives over a wilted rose. In the Farnese estate, the group strategizes about how they'll fight. Francisco is wearing a real slutty bathrobe. The group talks about how they can't organize the countryside without fear of arrest. A guy comes in saying that he's got the goods they ordered and brings in fruit that really hides a bunch of swords. Juliet is conflicted about how many will die. Conrad tells her, Lady Juliet, if we do not act in soon, Lord Montague's wholesale butchery will claim more lives than we ever could. Francisco says no one wants to put the blades to use. Curio adds, not until I stand before the prince.
I do have to appreciate Juliet in this moment, actually, because she is, of course, apprehensive because this does mean people are going to die on both sides, and she is aware of that, but she's also not backing down, and that's admirable, too.
So, Neil Verona is having a funeral
where Mercutio is delivering a eulogy about how his father totally wasn't killed by the prince. By the prince didn't murder my father eulogy is raising many questions already answered by my eulogy.
It's great because during this scene, all of the nobles are like, well, they say he got the prince's ire. I don't want the same.
Like, yeah. I love how everybody's just more or less a hostage at this funeral.
Yeah. Yeah, so everyone talks about how they could be next. Lady Hermione listens in. Montague approaches the tomb with a robe. Titus de Martese, my kinsman, you were a most exceptional friend, fast and true. And now, to your slumbering soul, all I can proffer are my paltry words. And he leaves a rose on the tomb. It's interesting how apparently the Montagues have made bringing these roses to the tombs and stuff apparently city-wide tradition for the nobles at this point.
I mean, well, you can't have those filthy commoner irises now, can you?
Yeah.
You can't have the irises at a funeral because it'd be a shame to have the wet-ass iris there. It's not appropriate.
At the village, Romeo is having trouble getting the soil to do anything. Paolo is mad, and Giovanni finds one of those cute little things you put in the water. Pietro comes with sword and wine. He says he traded in their blades. At the moment, things to kill folk are more in demand than things to sustain them. Giovanni sniffs an orange and thinks, so this is the fragrance of war.
I never expected it to be citrus.
Yeah. Romeo is traveling, trying to bring water in, and is warned to watch his step by the old man, and as a result is surprised and falls.
I love how Romeo is slowly transforming to Twink to Twunk.
Yeah.
Also, can we just hands off to Romeo for starting up a self-sustaining commune?
Yeah!
Right?
Yeah, that is what is happening. Romeo forms an anarchist commune.
I really wasn't expecting that going into this anime. But I am pleased to see it.
So, Romeo thanks the old man for sharing his food. The old man asks how Juliet is. Romeo tells him the world has forced them apart, but he's sworn to reunite them one day. The old man tells him, someday has outlived many a lover. See that you hasten its arrival. And gives him magic seeds. Juliet looks up at a tapestry and then sees Reagan and Amelia practicing for a play. Reagan is not really trying. Amelia gets mad and Reagan says, fine. Exit Reagan, stage left, and leaves. I love Reagan.
She's just so cute.
Amelia tries to get Juliet to take part, but Juliet's not in the mood. Amelia runs off angry and opens the door and says, the whole reason I came to Mantua was to nab myself a noble. But all you do is babble on about revenge and righting wrongs and regicide. If I had known it was going to be like this, I would have stayed home. Tell me when I get to meet a handsome, fabulous noble, damn it! We then see it's fucking Conrad she's talking to. I did not expect to say the words that I'm about to say, but Conrad and Amelia are a really good comedic duo.
They really are.
Also, I'm now realizing that the reason why I was confused when I started watching this show about why I like Conrad is because I just remembered this half of the show and not the first half with him.
Which is valid, because the first half of the show, he's so useless. He's more useless than the Jedi Council and the prequels.
Oof.
So
you're not wrong, but oof, ouch.
Right?
Balthazar pays a merchant who tells him about the miners. We see Romeo shirtless washing off when Giovanni and the others confront him about how the place isn't going to work out and it's a graveyard more than it's a village. Romeo reveals the magic seeds. He tells them they'll take root, and by winter, the village will be a place that they're proud to bring their families. After all, without them, they'd just be trading one prison for another. Giovanni says that perhaps doe-eyed dreams count for more than he thought. Pietro starts crying and the others laugh. They get to work while Paolo still has a look of, I hate this shit, on his face. Meanwhile, Balthazar tells Curio about the miners and he goes to tell the others. Juliet makes a speech from the play to Amelia while Francisco watches, muttering, genius. Shakespeare comes in on one of those toy horse stick things, saying, my kingdom for a horse, and claims the countryside has done wonders for his writing. Francisco comments, this crow is beautified with another's feathers. William admits that if he put it up in Neil Verona, the world would find itself short a bard. Amelia kisses Juliet mid speech. And yeah, as we were saying, she's just realized that she's bi, apparently.
She's just like, you know what? I'm going to be a bisaster, and that's it.
Yeah. So William says, there is a magic watching life writ large. Theater can touch one's heart, if but for a while. Those who come to my shows have a straight into their souls. A play might compel one to lay down their arms, or even take them up. Francisco smiles and says, now I see. The play's the thing. I like that this episode just has a thesis statement on Shakespeare.
Yeah. Same.
And just, I think, stage and plays in general and art in general. It kind of reminds me because, you know, I think, you know, we live in a society where to experience theater firsthand, it's either extremely cost prohibitive, it's limited to location, and it, just getting there, like a lot of those theaters aren't made with disabilities in mind or just the way they're set up or done. If you have sensory issues, it's very hard to enjoy it, though a lot of places are slowly starting to offer quiet hours.
Yep.
But it kind of reminds me, you know, especially nowadays, like I'm really glad they're showing how theater, especially at the time, really did have a lot of political and social commentary. And also that just to go slightly off tangent, like it kind of reminds me of like musicals. Like people are like, oh, why did they sing in musicals? I'm like, because if your emotions are too overwhelming, you can't use words, then you sing. And if you can't sing, if it's too much to sing, then you dance. And I think this kind of shows the beauty of stage and theater, and I just really appreciate that.
Yeah, and like I think that the musical song can in a lot of ways be compared fairly directly to the soliloquy in Shakespeare, which is like a unrealistic device, obviously, but like gives an unprecedented amount of insight into a character's interiority.
Exactly.
So at the village, everyone has been working hard. Meanwhile, William brings his play as people read through it and realize they are in it. Amelia is enraged to find that she's the nurse. William points out it would be weird if she was in a couple with Antonio. He says Reagan will be the star. Conrad wonders if young people have taken leave of their senses. William offers him the role of the tyrannical king, and Conrad says, I'll show you tyranny.
I also like how this shows that art is political, like media is political, all art is political to some extent.
Yeah, Francisco laughs in the background. Francisco and William basically flirt with Curio until he agrees to paint the flyers because apparently he's a very good painter.
Also,
Hidden Depths.
Also, I love how they flirt with Curio, and Curio isn't upset with the flirting. Curio is upset with the fact that he hasn't painted in forever.
Yeah.
I love that so much. I kind of just want Curio and
Francisco?
Yes, Francisco. I kind of want Curio and Francisco to just have an apartment together and like be gay.
That's what everybody wants.
I want them to be gay, and maybe they can swing sometimes.
Be yeah. gay, have an apartment.
Maybe they can like, well, they're already doing crimes. They need an apartment, and they can like polycule with Francisco, Curio, and William.
Yeah,
I kind of see that.
At the camp, Romeo leaves the others and tries to get Paulo to join them for a meal. Paulo complains that the food still won't bring a single ducat, and that he was always loyal, and now he's screwed. Romeo tells him the land is a second chance, and that Paulo's experience could be valuable. On the land, they practice the climax with Balthazar playing the Prince Montague character. William C. says the scene isn't working and Juliet needs more passion. He adds, "This is why I prefer men," with that exact emphasis.
I love this version of Willie Sakes is just super, is just really gay.
We're no longer doing subtext.
Juliet thinks about how she can't hate Montague and she needs to think about what she can do. Curio and Francisco are inside the house. Curio asks Francisco why he forswore all else for Juliet. Francisco says, "It's simple, my friend. That girl is our one hope in this sullied world. Juliet will be the architect of a Neo-Verona that not have yet seen. That is why." Curio asks if Juliet's own happiness must lie in ashes for that to happen. And Francisco says that he values her happiness in equal measure. Curio asks him what he'll do if he has to choose. Francisco says, "There can be no joy for her until Neo Verona has known redemption. And to that end, there is nothing you could not happily part, even my life." Curio realizes that Francisco loves her too. The two of them share a glass of wine, as Curio says, "Heartache is a lesson left to oneself." So we get a cute montage of the group preparing for the play. Juliet looks out the balcony holding her sword. The group dresses as sheep to get people to come to it.
Antonio, I love that. It's a clever little callback.
Yeah.
To what does sheep say?
Bah. Antonio hears about the miners. Juliet says she can't go today, but William arrives and says, "Bind your heart any more tightly, and it's bound to bust out of your corset, my dear. By the time the curtain falls on our play tonight, you'll be the darling of Mantua. They'll all love you. You'll find yourself hard-pressed to rendezvous with your paramour." Curio tells her, "No one will fault you for running to him. If they do, the devil take them." Juliet goes, Curio goes as her bodyguard, and William goes, "If this is a dream, may I never again awaken." Shakespeare was the original shipper on deck.
He really was.
I was taking a drink when you said that, and I almost just spit it out on my computer.
Romeo's house is full of things to make, and he has an iris he's left on his pillow. Curio prepares to defend Juliet, but all the miners are friendly. They recognize her immediately as Romeo's beloved. We see the village has changed, and all the miners talk about how Romeo has showed them a new way to live. And
God, I love that so much. I do have to say, I love how Romeo has this, like, genuine charisma and genuine leadership ability to him.
Yeah.
It's so good.
At the church, Romeo thinks about how he wants to plant flowers after the vegetables flourish. He sniffs an iris and says to himself, "Tell me, Juliet, which would please you?" Juliet's voice comes through. "Hard to say. Many a blossom is beautiful. But if I could have only one, roses evermore." The two of them embrace and kiss. It's a very romantic and sweet scene. The episode preview is "Yon hero soul in crimson armor bright, yon pride a mantle heavy as a pall. A hope is launched aloft on currents light. And in that moment, friend, I hear your call."
This anime is so good.
It's really wonderful. I thought the kiss, it's in the middle of the church. They're right by the stained glass windows. Like, a little rainbow light comes in. You get an outside shot of, like, the church and all these irises blowing in the wind. Ugh. I love how they're not afraid to just be unabashedly sweet.
Yeah.
They're unabashedly sweet in this, like, admittedly really harsh setting. And that's the contrast there makes both the setting and the, like, harsher things more impactful while also making the sweeter things even sweeter.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And we got to see, like, really good stuff with, like, a lot of the characters' development. Elizabeth, what are your predictions? A prediction you've been making since episode one came true this episode.
Which prediction was that?
Elizabeth predicted that there would be stuff involving a play that all the characters had to act in like the first episode.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, wow.
That is happening.
Yeah. Yeah, like, the thing is, I'd forgot that happened, and I was just like, oh yeah, that'd be cool, but I was thinking, oh yeah, that'd be cool, but it doesn't really happen in the show, but, like, I was wrong, and it absolutely does happen in the show.
How many episodes are left?
This was episode 18, so 19, 20, 21, 22, 5.
So we're getting like right into the, like, home stretch then.
Yep.
There's 25 episodes? Or 26?
There's 24 episodes.
So we're at, like, we only have 3 episodes left to do to cover that. Wow.
Yep.
So we're getting right into the home stretch. So are we about to have this play that, like, frames, like, the recap of everything? Are we about to have our Ember Island Players episode?
To an extent, I think it's a little bit different because they're bringing in things that aren't from the actual, that are from the Shakespeare play, but not from the show. Like, Amelia's playing the nurse in this, and, like, the closest thing we have to the one nurse is Cordelia, I guess, but Cordelia isn't actually, like, an old nurse. She's just a mom friend.
So it's a recursive adaptation. The adaptation is adapting the original source material for an episode.
Yes.
I love that. That's really cute. Very meta.
Yeah.
Nice.
Do we have any predictions for what's going to happen?
Revolution.
I'm worried about poor William's mother and him if word gets out that he's the one that made this play.
I feel like she can probably hold her own.
Yeah.
I don't know. Seems like, I don't know, Papa Montague seems like he's kind of getting a little frayed.
He's getting a little frayed, and he is ruthless, but also I feel like she is probably, like, ruthless doesn't mean evil, and she gives me the same sort of, like, ruthlessness that he does without the rage, and that's, in a lot of ways, more terrifying.
Right.
God, ruthlessness yeah. without the rage is kind of how I played New Mary. Yeah. And we know how that went.
For listeners who are not aware of this, Lydia is referring to the first character in one of our campaigns together where the character ended up taking over the world.
Not the first character in a campaign together, the first character that took over the world.
Yeah.
And note the use of first. She isn't the only character of Lydia's that have taken over the world.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I'm not.
That's fair. I'm not sorry. It was very entertaining and it didn't actually upset anyone. It was great. That character is coming back in other games as a big bad.
Yeah. We are drifting.
We are drifting. Is there
anything else we want to... We've basically done predictions and reviews at this point. Are there any other predictions?
Not at the moment. I feel like we're pretty good. I think this was an episode where we really got into a lot of like thematic stuff and implications and all that.
I'm yeah, still for sure. very confused as to what's going on with Treasus.
Same.
And I want to know more.
Oh, you'll get to know them more.
Cool. We have like 6 episodes of this anime left. And it feels like there's a lot to wrap up.
It really does.
But I think that with the quality of this anime being what it's been, I think they're going to do a really good job wrapping this up.
This may be a love that can never be, but our love for this series is not. I'm Zeb Berrybin. This has been Anime's Journey to the West. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at Anime's Journey TW, as well as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This may be a love that can never be, but our love for this anime is not.